Addendum Jitson, Chapter 2, Consecration to Missionary Life, 1809-1812. In September 1809, young Judson, at the age of 21, began to ponder seriously the subject of foreign missions. He had just finished his first year of study at Andover. Another year of theological course remained. At this time there fell into his hands a sermon preached in the parish church of Bristol, England, by Dr. Claudius Buchanan, who had for many years been a chaplain to the British East India Company. The sermon was entitled, The Star in the East, and had for its text Matthew 2:2, "For we have seen his star in the East, and are come to worship him." The leading thought of the sermon was the evidences of the divine power of the Christian religion in the East. Dr. Buchanan described the progress of the gospel in India, and especially the labors of the venerable German missionary, Swartz. This sermon fell like a spark into the tinder of Judson's soul. In a letter written many years afterward, he says, quote, "Though I do not now consider that sermon as particularly excellent, it produced a very powerful effect on my mind. For some days I was unable to attend to the studies of my class, and spent my time in wondering at my past stupidity, depicting the most romantic scenes in missionary life, and roving about the college rooms, disclaiming on the subject of missions. My views were very incorrect, and my feelings extravagant, but yet I have always felt thankful to God for bringing me into that state of excitement which was perhaps necessary in the first instant to enable me to break the strong attachment I felt to home and country, and to endure the thought of abandoning all my wanton pursuits and animating prospects. That excitement soon passed away, but it left a strong desire to prosecute my inquiries and assert the path of duty. It was during a solitary walk in the woods behind the college, while meditating and praying on the subject, and feeling half inclined to give it up, that the command of Christ, 'Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature,' was presented to my mind with such clearness and power that I came to a full decision, and though great difficulties appeared in my way, resolved to obey the command at all events." Unquote. 6 months elapsed from the time of his reading Buchanan's Star in the East before he made the final resolve to become a missionary to the heathens. This was in February 1810. He was, no doubt, stimulated to form his purpose by a close contact with several other young men of like aspirations. When a man is rocking in the troughs of the sea of indecision, it is very reassuring to have his interior conviction matched by his external providence. His early missionary associate was Samuel Knott, Jr., who entered the seminary early in the year of 1810, and was even then weighing the question whether he should devote himself to the work of carrying the gospel to the heathen. About the same time, there came to Andover 4 young men from William College: Samuel J. Mills, Jr., James Richard, Lutheran Rice, and Gordon Hall. While in college, these students had formed a missionary society, and they were accustomed to meet together at night beneath a haystack near the college grounds. At Williamstown, on the spot where now stands the famous haystack monument, these young men consecrated themselves to the work of foreign missions and poured out their fervent prayers for the conversion of the world, and this green nook among the Brookshire Hills may well be called the birthplace of American foreign missions, as great scientific discoveries have seemed to spring up almost simultaneously in the minds of independent and widely spread thinkers, sometimes engendering a strife as to the original discoverer. So this grand thought of evangelizing the heathen seemed to have been in the atmosphere, and to have floated at almost the same time into the hearts of different young men living far apart. Christian society was like a field which, having been plowed and sown, has folded up in its bosom a potency of growth. Judson and his associates were like the first green shoots scattered far and wide that appeared above the ground and promised to be followed by countless others. It was after long meditation and prayer and in communion with kindred growing spirits that the thought in Judson's mind of consecrating himself to the foreign mission work became a fixed purpose. There were many obstacles in the way. He was not going among the heathen because he could not find suitable employment at home. He had received a tutor's appointment in Brown University and had declined it. The Reverend Dr. Griffin had proposed to him as his colleague in the largest church in Boston. "And you will be so near home," his mother said. "No," was his reply. "I shall never live in Boston. I have much further than that to go." The ambitious hopes of his father were overthrown, and his mother and sister shed many regretful tears. He did not go abroad because he was not wanted at home. In the spring, in glory of his being, he went forth. From the embraces of devoted friends, from the ease and quiet happiness, he went forth, strengthened to suffer, gifted to subdue. The might of human passion to pass on, quietly to the sacrifice of all, the lofty hopes of boyhood, and to turn the highest ambition written on that brow from its first dream of power and human frame unto the task of seeming lowliness, yet godlike in his purpose. Whittier's The Missionary. It is a mistake to suppose that a dull and second-rate man is good enough for the heathen. The worst off need the very best we have. God gave his best, even his only begotten Son, in order to redeem a lost world. The most darkened and degraded souls need the best thinking. When our blessed Lord was presenting his gospel to a fallen Samaritan woman, he seems to have preserved his best thought for her, and in order to make a bad woman good, uttered in her ears the most august philosophical theses to be found in any tongue. God is the Spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Missions have had their grandest successes when England's best scholars like Bishop Patterson and Bishop S.E.L.W.Y.N. have devoted their splendid talents to the conversion of the fiercest and lowest savages of MICRONESIA and New Zealand. It would be a sad day for Christian, American Christians if they should ever deserve Nehemiah's reproach. Quote, "Their nobles put not their necks to the work of their Lord," unquote. Christianity will advance over the earth with long, swift strides when the churches are ready to send their best men and the best men are ready to go. Judson fully appreciated the dangers and hardships of a missionary life. He seems to have counted the costs. After one of the battles in the Franco-Prussian War, the German Emperor William had his attention drawn to one of the wounded soldiers on the field. The king held out his hand to the power-stained private and asked him what his trade was. The man said, "I am a doctor of philosophy, Your Majesty." "Well, you must have learned to bear your wounds philosophically," said the king. "Yes," replied the soldier, "that I had already made up my mind to do." Young Judson, before he had resolved to be a missionary, had made up his mind to the sufferings and privations which he knew well were in store for him. He thus wrote to Mr. Hasseltine of Bradford when asking for his daughter's hand, "I have now to ask whether you can consent to part with your daughter early next spring to see her no more in this world, whether you can consent to her departure to a heathen land and her subjection to the hardships and sufferings of a missionary life, whether you can consent to her exposure to the dangers of the ocean, to the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want and distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and perhaps a violent death. Can you consent to all this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you, for the sake of perishing immortal souls, for the sake of Zion and the glory of God? Can you consent to all this in hope of soon meeting your daughter in the world of glory, with a crown of righteousness brightened by the acclamations of praise, which shall redound to her Savior, from heathen saved through her means, from eternal woe and despair. This same anticipations of missionary sorrows pervade a pathetic letter written by him to Miss Anne Hasseltine during the period of their betrothal. January 1st, 1811, Tuesday morning. It was with the utmost sincerity and with my whole heart that I wish you, my love, a happy new year. It may be a year in which your walk will be close with God, your frame calm and serene, and the road that leads you to the Lamb marked with a purer light. May it be a year in which you will have more largely the Spirit of Christ, be raised above sublunary things, and be willing to be dispersed in this world just as God shall please. At every moment of the year will bring you nearer the end of your pilgrimage. May it bring you nearer to God and find you more prepared to haul the messenger of death as the deliverer and a friend. And now, since I have begun to wish, I will go on. May this be the year in which you will change your name, in which you will take a final leave of your relatives in the native land, in which you will cross the wide ocean and dwell on the other side of the world among a heathen people. What a great change will this year probably effect in our lives. How very different will be our situation and employment. If our lives are preserved and our attempt prospered, we shall next New Year's Day be in India, and perhaps wish each other a happy new year in the uncouth dialect of Hindustan or Burma. We shall no more see our kind friends around us, or enjoy the conveniences of civilized life, or go to the house of God with those that keep holy day. But swarthy countenance will everywhere meet our eye, the jargon of unknown tongue will assault our ears, and we shall witness the assembling of the heathen to celebrate the worship of idol gods. We shall be weary of the world and wish for wings like a dove that we may fly away and be at rest. We shall probably experience seasons where we shall be exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. We shall see many dreary, disconsolate hours and feel a sinking of spirit, anguish of mind, of which now we can form little conception. Oh, we shall wish to lie down and die, and that time may come soon. One of us may be unable to sustain the heat of the climate and the change of habits. The others may say with little truth over the grave, by foreign hands thy dying eyes were closed, by foreign hands thy decent limbs composed, by foreign hands thy humble grave adorned. But whether we shall be honored and mourned by strangers, God only knows. At least neither of us will be certain of one mourner. In view of such scenes, shall we not pray with earnestness, oh, for an overcoming faith, etc.? But what steps did he and his young associates take in order to execute this sublime purpose? There was at that time no foreign missionary society in America to which they could offer their services and which would undertake their support in the foreign fields. There was indeed the Massachusetts Missionary Society, founded in 1799, the object of which was to diffuse a missionary spirit among the congregational churches in New England and to carry the gospel to the Indians and to the newly settled parts of our own land. But this society had not yet launched upon the work of foreign missions, and so Mr. Judson and the young men who shared his purpose first proposed to each other to enlist as missionaries under the London Missionary Society. Accordingly, Mr. Judson wrote the following letter to the Venerable Dr. Bogue, the president of the seminary at Gosport, England, where the missionaries of the London Society received their training. Divinity College, Andover, Massachusetts, April 1810. Reverend Sir, I have considered the subject of missions nearly a year, and I found my mind gradually tending to a deep conviction that it is my personal duty to engage in this service. Several of my brethren of this college may finally unite with me in my present resolution. On their as well as on my behalf, I take the liberty of addressing you this letter. My object is to obtain information on certain points, whether there is at present such a call for missionaries in India, Tartary, that's T-A-R-T-A-R-Y, or any part of the eastern continent, as will induce the directors of the London Missionary Society to engage new missionaries, whether two or three young, unmarried men having received a liberal education and resided 2 years in this divinity school, wishing to serve their Savior in a heathen land and indeed susceptible of a passion for missions, whether such young men arriving in England that spring with full recommendations from their first Christian character in this country may expect to be received on probation by the directors and placed at the seminary in Gosport, if that be judged expedient, and whether provided they give satisfaction as to the fitness to undertake the work, all their necessary expenses, having arrived in England, shall be defrayed from the funds of the society, which funds will be, it is hoped, be ultimately reimbursed by supplies from the American churches. We have consulted our professors on this subject, particularly Dr. Griffin, professor of oratory. He intends writing to several in England, and perhaps to Dr. Bogus, it's B-O-G-U-E, but his engagements being such as will prevent his writing at present, and wishing myself to receive a letter from you immediately containing the desired information I have written myself. I close with an earnest request from you that you will please to transmit me an answer as soon as possible, and a prayer that your answer may be favorable to my most ardent wishes. Adudden Judson, Jr. P.S. I shall deem it a favor if you do not confine your remarks to the point which I have proposed, but are pleased to give such general information and advice as you may think will be useful to me and my brother. While awaiting a reply to this letter, these devoted students made their desires known to their teachers in the seminary and to several influential ministers in the vicinity. The professors and ministers met for consultation on the matter at the house of Professor Stewart in Hanover on Monday, June 25, 1810. These wise and conservative men advised the students to submit their case to the General Association, a body representing all the congregational churches of the state of Massachusetts, and which was to meet at Bradford the next day. Accordingly, on June 27, the students laid before the association the following letter. The undersigned, members of the Divinity College, respectfully request the attention of your Reverend Fathers, convened in the General Association at Bradford, to the following statement and inquiries. They beg leave to state their minds have been long impressed with the duty and importance of personally attempting a mission to the heathen, that the impressions on their minds have induced a serious and, as they trust, a prayerful consideration of the subject in its various attitudes, particularly in relation to the probable success and the difficulties attending such an attempt, and that after examining all the information which they can obtain, they consider themselves as devoted to this work for life, wherever God in His providence shall open the way. They now offer the following inquiries on which they solicit the opinion and advice of this association. Whether, with their present views and feelings, they ought to renounce the subject of missions as either visionary or impractical. If not, whether they ought to direct their attention to the eastern or the western world. Whether they may expect patronage and support from a missionary society in this country, or must commit themselves to the direction of a European society, and what preparatory measures they ought to take previous to actual engagement. The undersigned, feeling their youth and inexperience, look up to their fathers in the church and respectfully solicit their advice, direction, and prayers. Addendum Jetson, Jr. Samuel Knott, Jr. Samuel J. Mills. Samuel Newell. The names of Luther Rice and James Richards were originally appended to this petition, but they had been stricken out for fear of alarming the association with too large a number. The General Association, when they came to act upon this petition, passing the following resolution, voted that there be instituted by this General Association a board of commissioners for foreign missions for the purpose of devising ways and means and adopting and prosecuting measures for promoting the spread of the gospel in heathen lands. Voted that the said board of commissioners consist of 9 members, all of them in the first instance chosen by this association, and afterwards annually 5 of them by this body and 4 of them by the General Association of Connecticut. Provided, however, that if the General Association of Connecticut do not choose to unite this object, the annual election of all commissioners shall be by this General Association. It is understood that the Board of Commissioners here contemplated will adopt their own form of organization and their own rules and regulations. Voted that, fervently commending them to the grace of God, will advise the young gentleman whose request is before us in the ways of earnest prayer and diligent attention to suitable studies and means of information, and putting themselves under the patronage and direction of the Board of Commissioners for foreign missions, humbly to wait the openings and guidance of Providence in respect to their great and excellent design. Thus was organized the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, a society widely known and justly revered at the present day at the missionary organ of the Congregational Churches of America, and indeed the mother of American foreign missionary societies. The 9 men originally forming this board distrusted their ability to support in the foreign field those who had offered their services. They feared that the missionary sentiment among the churches of New England was hardly strong enough as yet to undertake so great an enterprise, and so they turned instinctively to their brethren in England, represented in the London Missionary Society, for aid and cooperation. They accordingly sent Mr. Judson to England to assert whether such cooperation would be agreeable to the London Society. The English directors gave Mr. Judson a courteous and affectionate greeting, but a joint conduct of the commissions did not seem practical to them. They were willing to receive and support Mr. Judson and his associates as their own missionaries, but did not feel disposed to admit the American Board to a participation with them in the direction of the work. Such cooperation might occasion complications, and they wisely thought that the American Christians were able to take care of their own missionaries. Mr. Judson embarked for England January 11, 1811, on the ship Packet. She was captured on the way by a French privateer, and so he was subjected to imprisonment and compulsory detention in France. On the 6th of May, he arrived in London, and on the 18th of June, he embarked at Gravesend in the ship Augustus, bound for New York, where he arrived on the 17th of August. Some interesting remnants of this voyage to England have been preserved by the pen of Mrs. E. C. Judson. There were in the ship Packet 2 Spanish merchants, and these, I believe, were the only passengers besides Mr. Judson. When they were captured by the invincible Napoleon, these 2 gentlemen, being able to speak French and most likely to furnish a bribe, were treated very civilly. Mr. Judson, however, was very young, with nothing distinctive in his outward appearance, and was moreover speechless, friendless, and comparatively moneyless. He was, without question or remonstration, immediately placed in the hold with the common sailors. This was the first hardship he had ever known, and it affected him accordingly. He shrank from the associations of the place, and the confined air seemed unendurable. Soon, the weather roughened, and he, together with several of his more hardy companions, became excessively seasick. The doctor visited him every day, but he could not communicate with him, and the visit was nearly useless. Sick, sorrowful, and discouraged, his thoughts went back to his dear old Plymouth home, then to Bradford, and finally the Boston Church, the biggest church in Boston. He became alarmed at the strange feeling that crept over him. It was the first moment of misgiving he had known. As soon as he became aware of the feeling, he commenced praying against it as a temptation of the adversary. It seemed to him that God had permitted this capture and all his troubles as a trial of his faith, and he resolved in the strength of God to bear it, as he might be called upon to bear similar trials hereafter. As soon as he had come to this resolution, he fumbled about in the gray twilight of his prison till he had succeeded in finding his Hebrew Bible. The light was very faint, but he managed to see for a few moments at a time, and amused himself with translating mentally from the Hebrew to the Latin, a work which enabled his thoughts and saved his eyes. One day the doctor, observing the Bible on the pillow, took it up, stepped towards the gangway, and examined it. Then returned and addressed his patient in Latin. Through the medium of this language, Mr. Judson managed to explain who he was, and he was consequently admitted to a berth in the upper cabin and a seat with his fellow passengers, the Spaniards, at the captain's table. His second day on deck was a somewhat exciting one. A sail was reported from the masthead, and while the stranger was yet a mere speck to the naked eye, many glasses were leveled curiously at her, and a general feeling of anxiety seemed to prevail among the officers. Of course, Mr. Judson was all excitement, for although he was now in comfortable circumstances, he dreaded the effect of his detainment on his mission to England. Finally, the stranger loomed up against the sky, a beautiful brig under a full press of canvas. As they watched her, some anxiously and some admiringly, finally her fine proportions became blended in a dark mass and was evident to the most inexperienced landsman that she had changed her course. The two Spaniards exchanged significant glances. Mr. Judson felt very much like shouting for joy, but he suppressed the inclination, and the next moment the order came for the decks to be cleared, and he with his companions were sent below. The Spaniards informed him that they were pursued by a vessel much larger than their own. That the privateer had little to hope in an engagement, but she was the swifter sailor of the two, and the approaching darkness was in her favor. Mr. Judson passed a sleepless night, listening each moment for unusual sounds, but the next morning when he carefully swept the horizon with the captain's glass, not a mote was visible. The privateer touched at La Passage in Spain, and there permitted the two Spaniards to go on shore. From thence, the prisoners were conveyed to Bayonne in France, and Mr. Judson again, to his surprise and indignation, found himself marched to the streets in company with the crew of the packet. He had as yet acquired only a few words of French, and of these he made as much use as possible, to the infinite amusement of the passerbys. Finally, it occurred to him that he was much more likely to meet some person, either a native or a foreigner who understood English, than to make his broken French intelligible. Accordingly, he commenced disclaiming in the most violent manner possible against the oppression in general, and this one act in particular. The guards threatened him by gestures, but did not proceed to violence. And of the passers-by, some regarded him a moment carelessly, others showed a little interest or curiosity, while many laughed outrightly at his seemingly senseless clamors. Finally, a stranger accosted him in England, advising him to lower his voice. "With the greatest pleasure possible," he answered, "if I have at last succeeded in making myself heard. I was only clamoring for a listener. You might have got one you would have been glad to dismiss if you had continued much longer," was the reply. In the few hurried words, Judson explained the situation, and the words as few learned that the gentleman was an American from Philadelphia and received his promise of assistance. "But you had better go on your way quietly now," added his new friend. "Oh, I will be a perfect lamb since I have gained my object." The prison was a gloomy-looking, massive structure, and the apartment into which they were conveyed was underground, dark and dismal. In the center was a sort of column, on which burned a solitary lamp, though without it was still broad day. Around the walls, a quantity of straw had been spread, on which his companions soon made themselves at home. But Mr. Judson could not divorce himself of the idea that the straw was probably not fresh, and busied his imagination with images of those who had last occupied it. The weather had seemed almost oppressively hot above ground, but now he shivered with the chilling dampness of the place, while the confined air and moldy smell rendered him sick and giddy. He paced up and down the cell. He could not tell how long, but it seemed many hours, wondering if his new friend really could help. And again, if he did not, whether he could keep his feet all night in case of fatigue, which part of the straw he should select as the least loathsome. And then his thoughts would wander off again to Plymouth and to Bradford and to the biggest church in Boston, but not with the feeling that he had before. On the contrary, he wondered that he ever could have been discouraged. He knew that at most his imprisonment could not last long. If he only had a chair or the meanest stool, thought that was all he would ask, but he could not hope to walk or stand long. While leaning against the column for a moment's rest, the door of the cell opened, and he instantly recognized the American he had seen in the streets. He suppressed a cry of joy, and seeing that the stranger did not look at him, though he stood close to the lamp, tried himself to affect indifference. The American, making some remark in French, took up the lamp, and then adding, or perhaps translating in English, "Let me see if I know any of these poor fellows," passed around the room, examining them closely. "No, no friend of mine," said he, replacing the lamp and swirling his great military cloak around Mr. Judson, whose slight figure was almost lost in its ample folds. Comprehending the plan, Mr. Judson drew himself into as small a compass as possible, thinking that he would make the best of the affair, though having little confidence in the clumsy artifice. His protector, too, seemed to have his doubts, for as he passed out, he slid some money into the jailer's hand and again, at the gate, made another disbursement, and as soon as they were outside, released his protege, with the expressive words, "Now run." Mr. Judson quite forgot his fatigue from walking in the cell as he fleetly followed his tall conductor through the streets to the wharf, where he was placed on board an American merchantman for the night. The next evening, his friend returned, informing him that his place of refuge had been only temporarily chosen, as the papers necessary for his release could not be procured immediately. He would be much safer in the attic of a shipbuilder who had kindly offered his place of concealment. Accordingly, he moved to the attic, from which, after a few days, he was released on parole. Mr. Judson passed about 6 weeks at Bayonne, boarding with an American lady who had spent most of her life in France. He told his landlady that he was a clergyman and frequently held long religious conversations with her, but he did not permit his character to be known generally in the house, as he thought it would interfere with the plan he had of learning as much as possible of the real state of French society. He attended various places of amusement with his fellow boarders, pleading his ignorance of the language and customs of the country as an excuse for acting the spectator merely, and in generally giving such evasive replies as enabled him to act his part without attracting undue attention. It was not long, however, before his companions became pretty well aware that indifference formed no part of his real character. His shrewdness was at variance with his implied ignorance of the world, and his simplicity sometimes wore a solemn impressiveness from the influence of which it was impossible to escape. The last place of amusement he visited was a masked ball, and here his strong feelings quite overcame his caution, and he burst forth in his real character. He declared to his somewhat startled companions that he did not believe the infernal regions would furnish more complete specimens of depravity than he there beheld. He spoke in English and at first addressed himself to the two or three standing near him who understood the language, but his earnestness of manner and warmth of expression soon drew around him a large circle, who listened curiously and with apparent respect. He spoke scornfully of the proud professions of the so-called philosophical of the age, and pointed out to the fearful exhibition of that moment as elusive of its effectiveness. He rapidly enumerated many of his evil infidelity had brought upon France and upon the world, and then showed the only way to escape from those evils, the despised but truly ennobling religion of Jesus Christ. Finally, he sketched the character of a man as it might have been in its original purity and nobleness, and then the wreck of soul and body, to be ascribed to sin and wound up all by a personal appeal to such as had not become too debased to think and feel. He had warmed as he proceeded from his subject, noting with pain and surprise the great number of those who seemed to understand the English language, and drawing from it an inference by no means favorable to his traveled countrymen. Most of the maskers evidently regarded the exhibition as part of the evening's entertainment, but those who understood his remarks seemed confounded by the boldness and perhaps unexpectedness of the attack, and when he had finished, stood aside and allowed him to pass from the place without a word. This incident, I have been told, was reported by some person present on the occasion and published in a Boston newspaper. Mr. Judson, I do not recollect by what means was introduced to some of the officers of Napoleon's suite and traveled to the country on one of the emperor's carriages. At Paris, he spent most of his time in the society of these officers and persons whom they introduced and in general persuaded the same course as at Bagne. In view of the opportunity thus afforded for observation and the store of practical knowledge really gathered, he always regarded his detention in France as a very important and indeed necessary part of his preparation for the duties which afterwards devolved upon him. In England he was received in a manner particularly flattering. He was at this time small and exceedingly delicate in figure, but the round rosy face which gave him the appearance of extreme usefulness. His hair and eyes were of a dark shade of brown, in his French passport described as chestnut. His voice, however, was far from what would be expected of such a person, and usually took the listeners by surprise. An instance of this occurred in London. He sat in a pulpit with a clergyman somewhat distinguished for his eccentricities, and at the close of the sermon was requested to read a hymn. When he had finished, the clergyman arose and introduced his young brother to the congregation as a person who purposed devoting himself to the conversion of the heathen, adding, "And if his faith is proportioned to his voice, he will drive the devil from all India." Soon after, Mr. Judson returned to America on the 18th of September, 1811. The American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions met at Wilchester, Massachusetts, and advised him and his associates not to place themselves at present under the direction of the London Missionary Society. It was also voted that Monsignor Dunjum Judson, Jr., Samuel Knott, Jr., Samuel Newell, and Gordon Hall be appointed missionaries to labor under the direction of this board in Asia, either in the Burma Empire or in Surat or in Prince of Wales Island or elsewhere as in the view of the Providential Committee. Providence soon opened the most favorable door. Thus the way was open for Mr. Judson to realize his ardent desire to become a missionary to the heathen. But he was not to go alone, for he was already betrothed by Miss Anne Heselton. They met for the first time on the memorable occasion already described, when in June 1810 the General Association held its session at Bradford, and the young Judson and his fellow students modestly made known their desires to attempt a mission to the heathen. The story is told that during the sessions the ministers gathered for a dinner beneath Mr. Hasseltine's hospitable roof. His youngest daughter, Anne, was waiting on the table. Her attention was attracted to the young student whose bold missionary projects were making such a stir. But what was her surprise to observe, as she moved about the table, that he seemed completely absorbed in his plate. Little did she dream that she had already woven her spell about his young heart, and that he was at that very time composing a grateful stanza in her praise. She was born in Bradford, December 22, 1789, and was about a year younger than Mr. Judson. Her parents were John and Rebecca Heseltine. She was an ardent, active, even restless temperament, so that her mother once reproved her in childhood with the ominous words, "I hope, my daughter, you will one day be satisfied with rambling." She was educated at Bradford Academy and was a beautiful girl, characterized by great vivacity of spirits and intensely fond of society. In fact, she was so reckless in her gaiety and so far overtopped her young companions in mirth that they feared she would have but a brief life and be suddenly cut off. At the age of 16, she received her first deep religious impressions. One Sabbath morning, she writes, "Having prepared myself to attend public worship, just as I was leaving my toilet, I accidentally took up Hannah More's strictures on female education, and the first words that caught my eye were, 'She that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth.' They were written in italics with marks of admiration and struck me to the heart. I stood for a few moments amazed at the incident and half inclined to think that some invisible agency had directed my eye to those words. At first, I thought I would live a different life and be more serious and sedate. But at last, I thought that they were not so applicable to me as I first imagined, and I resolved to think no more on them. After a struggle of several months, she could truly say, 'I began to discover a beauty in the way of salvation by Christ. He appeared to be just such a Savior as I needed. I saw how God could be just in saving sinners through Him. I committed my soul into His hands and besought Him to do with me as what seemed good in His sight. When I was thus enabled to commit myself into the hands of Christ, my mind was relieved from that distressing weight which had borne it down for so long a time. I did not think that I had obtained the new heart that I had been seeking, but felt happy in contemplating the character of Christ, and particularly that disposition which led Him to suffer so much for the sake of doing the will and promoting the glory of His Heavenly Father. A few days after this, I began to hope that I had passed from death unto life. When I examined myself, I was constrained to own that I had feelings and dispositions to which I was formerly an utterly stranger. I had sweet communion with the blessed God from day to day. My heart was drawn out in love to Christians of whatever denomination. The sacred scriptures were sweet to my taste, and such was my thirst for religious knowledge that I frequently spent a great part of the night in reading religious books." She threw herself with all her native ardor into the joys and labors of Christian life. She taught school for several years in Salem, Haverhill, and Newbury. Her constant endeavor was to bring her pupils to the Savior. Her decision to become a foreign missionary must have required great heroism, for thus far no woman had ever left America as a missionary to the heathen. Public sentiment was against her going. She thought to be wild and romantic. One good lady said to another, "I hear that Miss Heseltine is going to India. Why does she go?" "Why, she thinks it's her duty." "Wouldn't you go if you thought it's your duty?" "But," replied the lady, with emphasis, "I would not think it's my duty." [Footnote: For further particulars concerning Miss Heseltine's early life, the reader is referred to her biography by the Reverend J.D. Noel, K-N-O-W-L-E-S. End of footnote. On the 5th of February, 1812, Mr. Jetson was married to Anne Heseltine at Bradford. 2 days before, at Plymouth, he had taken final leave of his parents. His brother, L. Nathan, accompanied him to Boston. The journey was made on horseback. L. Nathan had not yet been converted. While out on the way, the two dismounted, and among the trees by the roadside, they knelt down, and the gentleman offered a fervent prayer in behalf of his younger brother. 4 days later, they parted, never to meet again on earth. The wayside prayer was not unheeded in heaven. Years afterward, Adenham was permitted to have the assurance that the brother over whom his heart so fondly yearned became an inheritor of the kingdom of heaven. On the 6th of February, he received ordination at Salem from the Reverend Dr. Spring, Worcester, Woods, Morse, and Griffin. On the 7th, he bade goodbye to his younger sister and companion of his childhood, and on the 19th, embarked at Salem with Mrs. Judson and Mr. and Mrs. Newell on the brig Caravan, Captain Hurd, bound for Calcutta. End of chapter 2. Have been read by Peter John Parisis.